On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. David Mahfood about Anselm and the Atonement, and we cover a ton of topics. We cover things like, what is the Atonement? What are the most common ways to think about it today? And how does Anselm really fit into this paradigm? Why would anyone think the incarnation and the cross are necessary for redemption? What's unique about how Anselm fits into answering this question? What is his account of freedom? Why does the majority of the medieval tradition reject Anselm's view? How does Aquinas on the Atonement compare to someone like Anselm? Does the necessity of atonement minimize God's freedom and the gratuity of grace? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook, or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church, and in endeavoring to think seriously about a lot of topics, we've tried to create or encourage or cultivate an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. So basically that means that we think that we should be virtuous thinkers in how we understand other people's arguments and how we treat them as human people, or I guess human persons is the proper term. And then also, flip side, we want to be very critical in what we in our rigor as we think. We found that a lot of people in our sort of context, me and Brandon started the podcast, we're both Baptists. If you think broader than that, sort of like American evangelical, whatever that word means, let's just assume it means something. There is a latent sort of anti-intellectualism, and if not an anti-intellectualism, a suspicion toward sort of more academic theology. And so we wanted to like make sure that we reverse that trend and say, no, this matters, but we want to treat people with kindness and care. And so hopefully in all of our interviews, that's what you experience. So if you're a new listener, you're going to find that we talk to all sorts of people all across the map. You're going to find that you agree with some people and you disagree with some people, and that's good. It helps you to just develop sort of like intellectual muscles that I think are congruent with the Christian life, because we think of things like James 3, the wisdom that is from above is meek, and it's open to reason, it's kind, it's gentle, and that's what we kind of want to promote here. Now, today, I'm thrilled to introduce you all to Dr. David Mahfood. We've interacted quite a bit on Twitter, and so he's a fun interlocutor there. It's amazing all the people you can meet online. I think it's really neat how that works, especially when you meet cool people, and you get to like learn and just kind of like have fun and spar back and forth. So I'm thrilled to talk to him about Anselm and the Atonement in particular. So there's going to be a lot of questions we have here. Before we jump in, David, tell me just a little bit about yourself. Like, what do you do? And then maybe what was it that first drew you to thinking about the Atonement and Anselm?
Hey, man. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I really enjoy what you do, and I'm grateful to be a part of it. Just a little bit about me. I actually grew up in Churches of Christ, so close in some ways to the Baptist perspective of this podcast. But I grew up in churches where you didn't go to seminary. You know, you didn't go study theology academically. So when I did my undergrad, I studied physics, and I enjoyed it. But at a certain point, I realized, hey, most of my free time I spend thinking about theology. And I thought at some point, hey, maybe I could do that. So I ended up going to graduate school for theology. And, you know, probably the biggest question I had was about the cross and atonement, and how to understand it, and, you know, difficulties with the typical ways that that's talked about, at least in my experience. And so early on in my master's degree, one of my mentor had me read Anselm, and I did not find what I expected to find based on what everybody says about him. So I was like, oh, this is interesting. And that led me to an MA thesis mainly on Anselm's methodology, less so on the substantive claims he makes. And then it led to a dissertation in my doctoral program that's more about the substantive stuff he says about the atonement. It reinterprets Curdeus Homo in some ways, and then tries to develop a picture of the atonement based on Anselm that I think is actually a pretty good one. and tried to defend it a bit. So that's how I got interested in this topic. I mean, I grew up a Christian and grew up believing this is how we're saved. And so, you know, I found in Anselm a really helpful interlocutor to think about how that all works. The other thing I wanted to say before we dive in was, I don't know if you know this, but my background philosophically, for what it is analytic as well. So, you know, I did my PhD with Billy Abraham, who was a big voice in analytic theology. And so I appreciate that aspect of what you bring to the table as well. And Anselm fits so neatly with that kind of precision and pursuit of rigorous arguments. So that,
yeah, Billy Abraham was really, like, I view him sort of like as a model theologian in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Southern Methodist, him and Bruce Marshall together, I mean, yeah. It's hard to beat those guys.
Well, and Bruce probably is more, like, Billy came away from this dissertation, which you looked at, I think totally unconvinced, but which is fine. He was fine with me writing a dissertation that he ultimately disagreed with, but Bruce was more sort of on board with it. But Billy is great. I just finished, actually, a couple weeks back, a chapter for a book about Billy and his work on philosophy of religion, and it was really lovely to write that. But it got me thinking about philosophy again in a way I hadn't done in a while, and so I was just thinking about that.
That's awesome. So I guess to set the table for talk about the atonement, in particular Anselm, maybe just help me to understand, like, sort of like the common ways of thinking about the atonement today, and then where is it that Anselm might fit in that conversation?
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about that at kind of two levels. One is the sort of substance, what Anselm, or what people say about how the atonement works. And then two, about sort of what the task of atonement theology is, the sort of understanding what's this all about. First, so obviously in a lot of churches, especially conservative ones, and in general sort of popular understandings of Christianity, I think you have a pretty unsophisticated version of penal substitution is probably the most popular. In other words, God has to punish sin because he's just, and so to spare us from punishment, God punishes Jesus instead of us, and therefore we can be forgiven. That can be worked out in a lot of care, but in the way it's preached in churches and in our songs, sometimes it often isn't. But that view, whenever it's come up in the history of the church, has always inspired opposition as well. And you actually see that in Cur Deus Homo. Anselm's interlocutor in that text asked the question, well, how is it okay for God to punish his son who's innocent? And Anselm says, well, he didn't. Right. So there's a opposition to that view that goes deep historically, but it also produces what is often talked about as the moral exemplar view, which is probably really popular in liberal theological circles, where Christ saves us by his example of God's love for us and his example of human love for God, things like that. And nowadays, in academic circles, it's probably common to try to recover patristic ideas like Christus Victor, where Christ saves by defeating the devil for us, recapitulation, where God saves by kind of living through the stages of human life, but righteously, recapitulating what humanity got wrong and enabling us to participate in the divine nature and that sort of thing. There's a lot of recovery of that stuff that's common in at least academic circles nowadays. And I want to say, in a certain way, Anselm fits with all of that except the first one, right? All of that except for the lazy version of penal substitution. Because he actually is going to affirm most of that. And that brings me to the methodological piece, which is the common way to frame this doctrine is to say, well, in the history of the church, you have several theories. You have the Christus Victor theory, and you have the moral exemplar theory. And the task of atonement theology is to figure out, well, what's the best theory? And that leads people to kind of look for figures to identify a unique, distinct theory they can set against other theories. And so you get where, if you say, well, Anselm articulates what we call a satisfaction theory, that means he's not in favor of a Christus Victor theory or a moral example theory. You've got to pick one. And that's the first thing that surprised me when I read Anselm, is he actually says, oh, Christ had to defeat the devil for us. He says that Christ, it's extremely fitting that Christ sets an example for us. That's part of how he saves us. So I discovered Anselm holds Christus Victor and he holds Moral Exemplar. And I would argue he holds Recapitulation. And so you've got the methodological piece is like, oh, this way of thinking about the doctrine just isn't quite right, or at least it could be misleading. So I think Anselm doesn't fit into just one of those theories. He actually gives you a synthetic picture. And the vision of the task of atonement theology that I've picked up from Anselm is basically this. What you have is a series of elemental claims about what Christ does. He defeats the devil. He sets us a saving example. He gives us a saving teaching. He offers a perfect sacrifice that erases the debt of sin. And you've got to figure out how to make sense of all of that. That's the task of atonement theology. It's not to pick one, nor is it to just say, well, we can just mash them up. But you've got to figure out how do they relate? How do they fit together to be a coherent story? And I think that's really what the task of atonement theology is for Anselm, and probably for a lot of pre-modern figures. For Athanasius, I think this is true as well. It's really the modern period where you get, no, you've got to have a clean typology. So there's a big double answer to your question.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. And before I move on with Anselm, I am a little curious. You sparked my ideas here, and I know Joshua McNall has the book, The Mosaic of Atonement. Is what he's doing in any way similar to how Anselm's thinking?
It is. I think the key difference is McNall is committed to retrieving penal substitution in a way that I think Anselm just isn't. Depending on how you, I mean, again, these terms can get so fine grained. And what does it mean to punish? And what does it mean? McNall, I read his book and I was like, I'm not sure he wants to say that God is punishing Jesus. And so he's very careful about that. So I think, does that count as penal substitution? Well, for him it does, but for a lot of people, that would seem to be the essential claim of penal substitution that they're worried about, is God punishing Jesus. So anyway, the difference would be that he's trying to retain that piece. But I was, that one, and there's another one, Jeremy Treat has a book called The Crucified King.
Yeah.
Both of those books, when I read them, I thought, oh, we're doing something very similar, which is trying to give a picture which holds these things together. So yeah, absolutely.
Okay, that's helpful. So I wanted to zero in a little bit on the necessity and fittingness piece. So I know I heard you mention a couple of times, you know, Christ had to, and it was fitting. And I know there's a lot of conversation about, like, is the atonement, or I guess the incarnation and the cross, those sort of things, are they necessary? Are they fitting? And it seems to me that those terms might mean different things. So just like help me to understand that general conversation before I press in on some questions about like, is this coherent or not?
Absolutely. That's a great question. And the first thing I want to say is, I think looking at the medievals, you can sort of see that actually you could hold a satisfaction view without agreeing with Anselm that it's necessary. You could think it's just, this is God, how God chose to work. But Anselm wants to say it's necessary, so we're going to unpack that. Here's how I would basically tell this story. I think Christianity obviously begins with the idea that the incarnation and cross are actually how God saves us. And early on, you have a lot of pagan objections and Jewish objections that's absurd, right? That it's unbefitting of God to say he became human, unbefitting of God to say he died on a cross, right? So you get Christian thinkers like Athanasius or Origen who want to argue it's actually really good that God did this. It's not unfitting at all. And the way they tend to do this is, take Athanasius on the incarnation as a great example of this. First, God would not be good if he just allowed humanity to fall away entirely from the purposes for which he made them. So that's not an option. Second, God goes to these lengths to save us shows how good he is. It's actually extremely fitting. And then to show that, what Athanasius does is to take each piece of the narrative and show this is really, really good. It's really good that he did it at this time and in this way and on a cross rather than dying of illness and all this stuff. And the picture that you get from all that could easily suggest that, well, with all that in mind, obviously this is what God would do. Because of who he is. How could he possibly do anything else? So that leads to the idea of necessity, that given the situation, and given God's perfection, necessarily this is what God would do. Athanasius doesn't quite say that. Nobody quite says that, but you can see how it gets there. The other side of it is there's a tension there because everyone also wants to say that God is free and that we don't want to say somehow God is constrained to do this, that he's stuck doing this. We want to say he's free. We want to say his grace is not obligated. It's just it's out of his goodness and generosity. And so there's in the patristic tradition, I think you just have both sides of that tension. Like in Augustine will say, God could have saved us another way. But there's a tension there. So I think that all comes to a head in Anselm. Part of this is because with Anselm, I think we're at the beginning of scholasticism. He's a Benedictine monk, but he's also trained in Boethian logic. And, you know, part of who he was, extremely precise. So he brings a precision and clarity here to try to hold this tension together. His concern is apologetic, like Athanasius. He wants to show to people who don't accept it that actually this is really, they should believe it. They should believe God would become incarnate. So he wants an argument that shows that if you grant certain things, now it's a little tricky to specify which things, but it would include that there's a God, that he created us for blessedness and communion with him, but that we sinned, then he thinks it follows necessarily, that is, it could not be otherwise, that God would become incarnate and save us by an offering of his own human life in resistance to sin, and thereby satisfy the debt of human sin and offer God the honor which humanity owed, so that, by joining ourselves to him, sinners could be forgiven. And Anselm thinks you can reconcile that necessity, which he wants to be a pretty serious logical necessity, with God's freedom, because he thinks freedom is not about the ability. Well, we can talk about freedom actually a little later, but he thinks he can reconcile it with God's freedom and with the gratuity of grace. His account of freedom, we'll see, is not libertarian. It's not about whether you could do otherwise. So that's part of why. I think basically Anselm puts the problem in the starkest terms, and that then leads to some other developments, which we might talk about next, I guess.
Yeah. Now you've got my interest piqued in the freedom discussion. 'Cause I know Catherine Rogers was pretty strongly argued that Anselm is a libertarian, correct?
Well, okay. When it comes to humans.
Okay. When it comes to humans, got it.
And, the reason is and it's not about freedom. For Anselm, freedom doesn't require the ability to do otherwise, but otherwise the saints in heaven would not be free,
right?
And Christ would not be free, right? Because we would say Christ would not sin necessarily, at least Anselm would say, Christ necessarily would not sin. So freedom is not the issue, but for moral responsibility, Anselm thinks your choice has to come from you. It can't be dictated by the nature you're given. So Anselm comes up with a way to say that humans and angels have the capacity to sin or not at some point. And then necessity will follow from that later. Like if you sin, then you might become fallen in a way that now necessarily you sin. But it came from you to begin with. But God is unique because God has a aseity. And so whatever God is from himself. And so there's no one else to blame. And so therefore God... Rogers wants to defend a necessitarianism about God pretty strongly, which some other Anselm scholars disagree with. And I think she goes a little far because he never says this. He never says this. But he does want to say that, at least with the incarnation, if the incarnation is the most fitting way to save, and God could not do it, that would mean God is less than perfectly free, because God might fail to act towards the best thing. And that's a kind of liability. It's a kind of weakness. It's not a kind of freedom. So that helps.
On fittingness, is there any sort of like, I mean, I know he's not going to lay out like, here's the necessary and sufficient conditions for what counts as fitting. But like, some sort of like intuition that he's working with where it's like, well, it's like beautiful, or it's like shaped in a particular way. Like, what is his account of fittingness supposed to work out?
Yeah, you know, I'm not aware that he ever defines it. Conveniens is the Latin term, right? It gets a stricter sort of treatment later by other thinkers. Who take his arguments and develop them. Certainly Aquinas and certainly like Robert Grosseteste is another one who where you can see developments on this. But I don't think he defines it, but I think you've got the gist of it, which is there's a certain beauty to things or an ugliness to things, which would be unfittingness. And so he doesn't really need you to agree on like the essence of fittingness. He just needs you to agree like, well, this would be unfitting, so God can't do it. And it, unless you would say, no, that is fitting, you have to follow his reasoning. Because no one wants to say God could do what's unfitting. At least Anselm thinks no one would ever say that. So I don't think he defines it, but it is this kind of aesthetic criterion. It's also kind of moral, right? Bad things are obviously not fitting of God. And I think it actually, if you want to really develop it, you'd have to go to the proslogion, because like the concept of God as that than which a greater cannot be thought, like gives you all these perfections. And so fittingness, I think, flows directly from that. Like God would not be that than which a greater can't be thought unless he always does what's maximally fitting, what's best, what's maximally beautiful. So yeah, hopefully that gives you a sense.
That's perfect. That's helpful. So I want to know a little bit about why it seems that, based on, if I read you correctly, the majority of the medieval tradition seems to want to push back on the necessitarian aspect.
Yeah, so I think the way I read the history, and it, you know, I'm only so-so with this, right? This is like so much history to try and like digest. But the way I read it is Anselm articulates that problem in a really decisive way. And then from there, the scholastics pick up the concern for God's freedom and God's power in a much more robust way than happened before. So with Aquinas, well, you know, there's lots of details here, but with Aquinas, he's more nervous about saying it's necessary, and he's a lot more detailed and fine-grained in different kinds of necessity, right? If you start to read Aquinas, you start to see, is it necessary? And he'll say, well, there's two senses. Necessary is said in two ways. And then the next time he says it again, necessary is said in two ways, but it's two different ways. So like by the end, you've got like a lot of different kinds of necessity. But he wants to say, like he'll say it's necessary supposing the end in mind, right? So like supposing God's chosen to do this, then it's necessary that he does it. And you almost wonder like, is that just trivial, you know, or what do you mean? But he's very nervous about saying it. But then with Duns Scotus, it's like even further. He wants it to be a really undetermined choice on God's part. So while Scotus, more than Aquinas, like takes up Anselm's account of what God actually does in the atonement, but he pushes back real hard on the necessity. He wants to say, no, God could have done otherwise. God could have valued. So he'll say, if God chose to accept from Adam some act of obedience as satisfaction, God could have done that. And that would have been fine because it's up to God. And it would have been fitting because God chose it. And so he pushes back on the necessity piece quite hard, I think harder than Aquinas does, and towards what some might call voluntarism. I want to be careful about that, but he pushes harder in that direction in ways that I think are worth grappling with. While affirming the substance, that what Christ does is make satisfaction.
Yeah, okay. How does Aquinas' paradigm on atonement in general compare to Anselm?
Yeah, this is a great question too. I think Aquinas is greatly underappreciated on atonement. And I think part of it is because his presentation of the atonement, such as it is in the Summa Theologiae, doesn't seem to offer a distinct theory in the sense that everyone wants to look for. With Thomas, what you get is more like this. You know, he'll say, well, does Christ save by making satisfaction? Yes, and here's how. Does Christ save by defeating the devil? Yes. You know, does he save by sacrifice? Yes, right? So, and part of the difference may be due to genre, right? So I think what Anselm's doing in Cur Deus Homo, it's a dialogue, and it's trying to do a particular thing, which is show the incarnation is necessary. And so what he emphasizes is what he finds as a sort of logical hinge that he thinks gets you necessity. He's not giving a comprehensive, systematic treatment of the atonement. He's not saying everything there is to say about it. He's just saying, here's what makes it necessary. Thomas is writing a Summa, right? So he's more synthetic, more comprehensive. He's going to consider everything that he can think of that there is to say and say why it's so. So for that reason, I actually think Thomas is probably a better like place to start. If you're just a like, what do I do with this doctrine? Tom, like reading those bits of the Summa, the Tertia in part three, question 46 to 48 or so, just great little bit where you get all these different pieces from the tradition all in there. So that's a big difference in their presentations and in what you can get out of them. The other thing is, I mean, there's a lot of other little developments. One is to do with the sacrament of penance. For Thomas, he connects satisfaction to the sacrament of penance a lot more, in a lot more detail, right? Anselm doesn't do that at all, actually. So there's a lot of things like that where Thomas is just more thorough, more detailed. A lot of those, I think you can say that's a good addition or a bad addition, right? But you can sort of, it's development.
So I have no idea the history here. Is the sacrament of penance, does that like come into play like after Anselm more? And is that part of potentially the reason?
No, I mean, it existed before, but okay. I just think Anselm's not being systematic in that in quite Got the it. Way that he didn't write it nearly as much. Right. So it's hard to compare, you know. But for Thomas, right, it's he considers the question, I think, in actually a really neat way. Can you make satisfaction for someone else? And he says, well, you can if you're joined in wills with them. And in other words, like if I have to make now, you know, I'm not in the tradition that does penance. You know, you're not either. So this is just kind of like thinking about it. Right.
Yeah.
But for Thomas, right, if you can't do the penance that's assigned to you for whatever reason, infirmity or whatever, but we're friends, right? I might offer to do it for you, but that's effective to the degree that you will it along with me. You really want to, but you can't, right? And that, to me, that's actually kind of beautiful, right? There's something beautiful about looking at it like we as a human family owe to God this victory over the devil that he asked of us from our first parents in the garden. He asked them to obey in the face of temptation. And we all now, because of the fall, can't do it. Right. And so Jesus comes along and does it. And insofar as we're joined to his will, it's like we're doing it together in a way. Right. We're joined to him doing it, even though it's all his action. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think that's some nice development in Thomas, even though, again, the sacrament of penance is it just gives him an interesting development you can apply to how we benefit from his activity. Right.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. So one question that I have that I imagine maybe there's a good amount that seem to feel this weight of this worry is the necessity of the atonement in some way minimizing the gratuity of grace or God's freedom. I think that's probably a common question that people get with several doctrines, including divine simplicity. And it seems to me that the solution probably is similar in a lot of those ways. So just like walk me through, like, why would that necessity not minimize those things?
Well, so freedom, again, you have to sort of digest Anselm's view of freedom, which is that it isn't to do with being able to fail. So the analogy I give students is like this. Like, if you imagine a runner, imagine like the most perfect possible runner. A runner who always, if they're trying to run, always makes the correct step, right? Always makes exactly the correct step, given all the circumstances, how fast they want to run, the terrain, etc. Could a perfect runner trip? And I'd have to say, well, no. They could dive, right? They could fall on purpose, but they couldn't trip. Because tripping seems, at least as I'm going to use it, the term now, is going to be basically accidentally, right? Making a mistake, making an error. They can't do that because they're a perfect runner. For Anselm, freedom is kind of like that. It's like you always make the choice that is correctly suited to your end. And so God's freedom, God's more free than us because we can sin. And our freedom will be greater when we can no longer sin, right? When we're beatified. So that's a key piece of the freedom. The gratuity is a slightly different question. And Anselm considers it, and it's interesting, in Latin, right, the term gratia is a term for grace, which means like a gift or favor, but it also means thanks, right? And so the gratuity of grace for Anselm is like the fact that it evokes thanks. And that's the way he considers the question is if God has to do it, then do we even need to thank him? Like, why is it worthy of thanks? When someone just does what they're obliged to do, we don't necessarily say thank you, or at least not very seriously. So he considers it, but he says there's actually a kind of necessity that increases our gratitude. And the examples he gives there is like making a promise, where if I do something nice for you spontaneously, that's cool. But if I made a promise to do this now, I'm taking away some options from myself, right? I no longer have the option to not do it if I don't want to be called a liar. And that doesn't seem nice. So he's like, okay, so I've given up not only the not doing the thing, but actually the option of not doing it. And so in a sense, I've given even more to you by making the promise. And that's the analogy he'll give. So then if I do the thing willingly, now if I do it begrudgingly, like, fine, I promise to do this podcast, so I'll get on. Then you might say, well, that's a little less worthy of thanks, right? That's not very good. But if I promise to do a thing and then I do it willingly, it's actually more, in Anselm's mind, more to be thanked, more gratia, than if I just did it spontaneously. So it's like he compares it to monastic vows, right? The monk not only gives up the possibility of marital relations, well, so he doesn't just give up marital relations, he gives up the option of marital relations too. So it's even more. Now, if the monk does this grudgingly, that's not meritorious. But if he does it willingly, that's more. So I think you could liken it to marriage too, right? Like, you don't have to enter into a marriage, but if you do, you're not just doing the things you promise, you're doing even more by promising to do them. So that's his solution. I think actually that's kind of neat. There's something there. And I, oh, you know, the other piece I sent you, which was from the dissertation, was I was trying to push back on Bruce Marshall, because he seems more sympathetic to Thomas on this issue. Doesn't find Anselm's, though he does know it, doesn't find Anselm's answer here all that convincing. And I think it actually is a pretty good answer. But I think for most of the later medievals, it's just not good enough unless it could be otherwise. That's the sense of gratuity you really need, is that God would be perfectly good if he didn't do it. So that's the shape of the debate. Yeah. I don't know how to resolve it, but I like Anselm on it.
Yeah, no, I think my intuitions probably track closer to Anselm, but like I can totally see why someone would want to push back on that. It makes sense.
Now, me too.
Somewhat related question. I mean, when we're thinking about the shape of this debate, why is it that Anselm and others want to say that there must be satisfaction for sin? So why couldn't God just simply overlook it?
That's a great question, because a lot of people really get this wrong in the way they interpret Anselm. It's not that God is offended, right? It's not that God's like he's insulted. It's that I think the best way to think about it is the self-consistency of God's intention. It's part of his perfection. So put it like this. God put Adam and Eve in the garden and implicitly asks them to resist the devil. He doesn't say that, right? But he says, don't eat from the tree, knowing that the devil's there and is going to tempt them. So God has asked of them a victory over the devil. And that's a big thing to ask, right? But if God asks it, that must mean, actually, that's a really good thing to ask. It's actually really, really good. And so when we don't offer it, and not only that, I should say too, God asked that with the idea of rewarding humanity with beatitude for fulfilling it. God could have done something else maybe, but that's how he chose to have our obedience acted out, in order to reward us with beatitude. If we then fail to offer it, then the good thing that God will doesn't come to pass. And for Anselm, if God then just says, well, okay, no big deal, right? There's a deep problem there. There's an incongruity. There's an ugliness, right? The order of the universe is not maintained in the way that God laid it out to be. And he actually, one of my favorite little arguments in Curtius Homo, he says, imagine somebody was just made beatified without satisfaction. God just made them just. Well, what would they will? They would will the opposite of what they willed when they sinned. Which is to say, they would want their wrong to be set right. They would want to go back and fix that. If there's no satisfaction, that means it's not fixed. So they would have, Anselm says, an unfulfilled desire. And a beatified person can't have an unfulfilled desire, right? So he says there has to be satisfaction. By the way, like the way Eleanor Stump talks about Anselm, she will argue that he only thinks satisfaction is needed on God's end. But that argument is precisely that it's needed for us. It's dignifying to us because we can know we're invited into beatitude having done the thing God wanted us to do. Like, not me, but Christ, right? And insofar as I'm in Christ, I'm part of the family which has offered God the honor he wanted from us. And that's something quite beautiful. So that's why I'd say at the end of the day, God cannot, for Anselm, cannot forgive without satisfaction, because it would be allowing ugliness, allowing the good he willed not to come to pass, and just pretending that it did. That's not befitting of the one who is that than which a greater can't be thought.
Right. So one thing that I wanted to make sure to ask you before I forgot was, you mentioned earlier on with Aquinas and sort of like the penance thing, the friendship relationship with atonement. Yeah. I'd love to just hear more about, like, what does friendship have to do with the atonement in general? Is that something that Anselm uses at all and deploys at all? Or is that just like a nice framework to think about it?
I think it's much more present in Aquinas. Anselm does say, right, when it comes to the reward of Christ's offering, Anselm does say, well, Christ himself doesn't need any reward, but he merits one. So what's fitting is that it be given to those who love him. So love is already there, right? And it doesn't use the term friendship, but love is there. But in Aquinas, friendship becomes a much, like, a crucial category. It's really interesting. And here, by the way, just to say it, I'm heavily indebted to a book by Daniel Schwartz called Aquinas on Friendship, where he traces this theme. And I think for Aquinas, it's crucial because, like, he has a certain account of friendship from Aristotle, where friendship is this thing between equals. It's a kind of union of wills between equals. But we have in John that Jesus says, I no longer call you servants, but friends. And so somehow we can be friends of God where there's radical inequality, right? So I think for Aquinas, it's a really interesting concept. Friendship with God becomes like a really deep theme in how he thinks of beatitude. It's a union of wills where our will is aligned with God, and we delight in him and he delights in us because we love the things he loves and we love him the way he's fit to be loved, right? So that's friendship. Now, satisfaction, I think, comes with this in view. You could see, well, it's kind of a way to restore friendship where it's been broken. If I've done something wrong and I've harmed you, now, for Aquinas, it's clear within friendship, like, you can pass over a lot of wrongs without satisfaction, right? You can just overlook it because, like, in virtue of the friendship, which is like this substantive thing. But some wrongs are so serious, right, that they break the friendship, where I'm opposing, like, the very thing that united us in some way. And at that point, the friendship is broken. And to restore it, satisfaction is a way to do that. If I try to repair the wrong, what's happening is my action is reflecting truth where it had reflected falsehood. Like, if I did the wrong, right? If I broke your window through negligence, right? I fix it, that acknowledges, well, I wasn't right to break it. That your window deserved to have its integrity respected. And I failed in that. Now I'm acknowledging that, right? So it's a way of moving wills back in alignment. I think of it like with my kids, you know, when they fight, you know, something's gone wrong. I said, well, you say sorry, you know, you pick it up, you give it to her, and then you give him a hug, right? I'm making them act out where their wills ought to be. And in a certain way, that's what's happening in the atonement, that Christ is acting out what a human will ought to do in the world of sin, which is resist temptation utterly, even to the point of death. And he does that, and that his will didn't need to be moved, but ours did, right? And insofar as we see it, we're like drawn into his movement of will, his love of God. And indeed, for Thomas, right, his love, the love of God, is poured out in our hearts by the Spirit. And that enables us to be friends of God and to will along with Christ. So the satisfaction moves us. And this is why Aquinas says, though God could forgive, in terms of justice, God could forgive without satisfaction. He saves through satisfaction because it's dignifying and merciful to us. It's better for us. It's purely generous. He doesn't get anything out of it, right?
Yeah.
We do.
So a common objection, it seems, to most atonement theories is, at least in our contemporary period, seems to be sort of like the oppressive nature of them, particularly abusive to women. Are Anselmian or Thomistic accounts, do they lead to abuse or oppression, or are they potentially... I guess, you know, if you want to bring in penal substitutionary atonement, then you might say, well, they're less abusive than that, potentially, if you construe it a particular way.
Good question. And I guess I would think there are different ways to apply these models. And so you could apply them in a way which is oppressive, which is what people point to. So, for instance, right, with take Anselm's account. For Anselm, right, Christ saves us by undergoing suffering he didn't deserve. And the love out of which he bore it, God honors. So one might think that means God just values passive suffering. And we imitate Christ by undergoing suffering that we don't deserve. So you get the story people tell, you know, I'm sure happens. I'm sure has happened, you know, where someone with an abusive spouse will be told, well, this is just your cross to bear. In other words, implicitly saying, right, you be like Jesus by just bearing it, by just suffering it. And I think that's oppressive, right? 100%. I think it says to people who perhaps could resist and get out of the situation without any bad result, right? Tell them, no, just stay in it. And you get people pointing to analyses of, like, African-American slavery in the United States that make this connection. Like, well, they're suffering just like Christ. And I think that's an oppressive application. But I think there's another way to make the analogy, and it would be this way, to say, instead of analogizing the victim as Christ, analogize the victim as the wronged person, right? And so the person who's been wronged, if Anselm's account of satisfaction is right, or if Thomas's is right, then that wronged person can be even kind towards the person who wronged them by not simply forgiving. Right? I mean, by requiring an act of satisfaction in terms of setting things right. Now, forgiveness, and we can parse that carefully. I would say they should forgive in some sense, but they might still require satisfaction. In other words, you might say, well, I forgive you in the sense that I don't will that you suffer. I'm not out to get you. But the wrong that you've done is so serious that we can't maintain the relationship unless you do something to set it right. That actually would move the will back into alignment with truth and justice. And so I think, like, that if Anselm's story is right, that's what God does to us. And so a wronged person could do that and not only be justified, but be loving by doing it. So I think there are better ways to apply the analogy that I would argue are not necessarily oppressive. So, and it can even help us think about how do we address situations like that in a just way.
Yeah, no, that's really good. So one thing I did want to have you spend a little time on is your own personal account of the atonement. How does that compare to something like penal substitutionary atonement? And when I say penal substitution, I mean the more consistent kind, not the sort of like Christus odium sort of stuff. I'm just going to ignore that.
That's fine. Yeah, no. And the truth is, like, I've spent less time on penal substitution. I get past the 14th century, and I'm like, eh. But that's my failing. That's not any comment on the quality. But I would say it's essential to affirm penal substitution in at least this sense. Christ undergoes sufferings that he didn't deserve, but we do. And they're the kind of sufferings, including death, which when we undergo them, because we're sinners, they are just punishments. And that's part of how he makes satisfaction for us. So we can say that Christ saves us by suffering our punishment in just that sense. But the difference is, for me, since he does not deserve those sufferings, and for him they're entirely voluntary, they're not properly speaking a punishment of him. they're not imposed on him the way a punishment necessarily is. He takes them on voluntarily, and so that's why we'd say, most properly speaking, it's an act of satisfaction. But it takes the form of taking things that are punishments for us. So, personally, I find that more morally intelligible. It enables me to say that God doesn't punish an innocent person in place of the guilty. In fact, that's what we unjust humans do, like when they crucify Jesus in place of Barabbas. Like, that's evil. That's not good. But at the same time, it gives a window into how his voluntary suffering of that very injustice, out of love, constitutes a beautiful offering to God. And in virtue of that, our debt is satisfied. So I think it lets you maintain all of the rich imagery and hymns and the language, you know, in Isaiah, right? By his wounds we're healed and all that stuff. And even like, it was the Lord's will to crush him, right? You can take that in a certain sense. I just think it helps you make moral sense of it a little better. And I recognize, like, gosh, the ways that penal substitution theorists have parsed this stuff out is so complex, and when you read some of it, I'm like, oh, okay, that's pretty much what I said. it's just, do you call it penal substitution or not?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah. So this is maybe a little bit tangential, but just something you said piqued my interest. So you mentioned how the event of the Son being crucified is experiencing an unjust event, and it seems, for whatever reason, people online like to say that they don't like the idea of that being unjust or him potentially being a victim of some sort. Is it true to say that Christ is a victim in it, even if it's necessary?
I think so. What is a victim? Okay, I'd put it this way. And this is just drawing on Thomas. Thomas takes up this question, and he will say, well, it was evil in terms of the intentions of the people who did it, but it was good in the intentions of Christ who underwent it. And of course we know, right, Christ himself says, right, no one takes my life from me, I lay it down of my own accord. So the ultimately determinative one is somehow Jesus, but the violence, right, and the evil comes from an evil will, a misjudgment. Jesus says they don't know what they're doing. But nonetheless, it's an injustice, and that he doesn't deserve it. And so I think you can't deny that. And it's helpful to be able to see that there's almost a kind of judo move to it, right? Is as evil as it is, that's how good it is that Christ is willing to undergo it. Anselm actually has one of his prayers. I don't know if this came up in your discussion with Thomas Williams. One of his prayers is the prayer to the cross. And he actually has this really poetic line. If we weren't doing a podcast, I would pull it up. But it goes back and forth between the intentions of the people who carried out Christ's crucifixion and his intention. He's like, they desired to kill life. You desired to bring life to the dead. And it's like all these little parallels. Mm-hmm. They intended to punish an innocent person. You intended to rectify the guilty. Like, it's all these little beautiful parallelisms. So you can start to see that, well, we don't have to deny that it's an evil event in a certain sense, but you can even catch that up into the beauty of that he undergoes it voluntarily, makes it even more lovely.
So I'm amazed that we have packed this much tremendous content into this space. So this has been awesome. I got to know, like, a twofold question. Number one, what future work are you currently working on that will be available to people in the next 1, 2, 3, 4 years? And then to follow up on that, is there a place that people can go to consistently find that?
Oh, you know, I'm an academic, so the answer to the second question is no. But you can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter is private at the moment, but if you try to follow me, I'll probably say yes. I'm on Blue Sky and Threads now too, so who knows where that's all going to go.
Yeah,
but okay. So let's see. I had the recent piece in the Festschrift for Bruce Marshall, Love Incarnate. Right? Oh gosh. Oh, because I'm trying to remember the title of the book. it's going to kill me. But anybody who wants to know, send me an email or find me on Twitter. dmafood@gmail.com is easy to find. But that came out recently. Like I said, I just finished an essay about Billy Abraham in a volume about his life and work. And I think another one of those coming up that I'll do another essay for. But as far as this stuff that we talked about today, you know, my plan is to get this dissertation, get a book proposal out pretty soon. And, so hopefully that's within 2 years, hopefully you'll be able to read it as a book. But right now, if you search on ProQuest, you could just read the dissertation version of it, which I actually think is reasonably readable. You can tell me if you agree or not, or you could lie, but there's that. Honestly, interestingly enough, one of the most interesting pieces to me about Anselm's treatment of the Atonement that isn't talked about much is the role of the angels, both good and bad. And so long term, I'd really like to pursue a project or a series of pieces, maybe a book, maybe a series of essays on the role of spirits in accounts of the Atonement. And if Christ sets right if Christ brings about the fulfillment of God's intentions in a cosmic way, is there a way that he sets right the relation between humans and other rational beings? It just figures really big in Curtius Homo, and a lot of people that I find will say things like, "Well, who cares if angels exist? Like, it's not it's an uninteresting question." And to me, it's like, no, this actually, they play a really crucial piece in this story that makes a big difference if they're just not there, at least on the face of it. So that's a question I kind of want to pursue long term.
Well, that's actually very interesting to me, at least. And whenever you get there, we'll have to do a podcast episode talking about that.
Absolutely.
So this has been awesome. So thanks, David, for talking with us about all this. I encourage everybody who's been listening to check out his work. Go follow him on Twitter and wherever else. Who knows how long Threads exists or the other. You know, it's funny to me. I'm like, there's like a 50-50 chance that something's successful. I remember Google+, and, you know, it kind of went by the wayside. So who knows?
Yeah, that one was pretty bad. Google Reader, you know, that should have stayed, but Google+ was terrible.
So, yeah. Anyway, thanks, guys, for listening. This has been the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, and we'll talk to you guys soon.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy 5 or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.